One ball, now two, and one strike. Half swing. That's going to cost a strike. And the Sox are down to their last strike. And this crowd is really ready to reach the heavens now. Got it!
It's been 30 years since the Mets won a World Series, but former starting pitcher Ron Darling remembers it like it was yesterday. He shared his memories before a sold-out crowd at a Gilderland Library event last Friday night. I spoke with him while he was in town about his new book, Game 7, 1986, Failure and Triumph in the Biggest Game of My Life. He also reflects on his own personal performance as a starting pitcher for the Mets and reveals why it disappointed him. Darling breaks down one of baseball's great forgotten games, a game that stands as a thrilling, telling, and tantalizing exclamation point to one of the best remembered seasons in Major League Baseball history. Ron Darling is an Emmy Award-winning baseball analyst for TBS, the MLB Network, SNY, and WPIX-TV, and author of The Complete Game. He was a starting pitcher for the New York Mets from 1983 to 1991, and the first Mets pitcher to be awarded a Gold Glove. Again, the name of the new book is Game 7, 1986, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Ron Darling to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe. I really appreciate it.
Very nice to have you here. So when you're thinking about specifically a game, and of course you tell many more stories than just about Game 7, but when you're thinking about just a game, how much of that do you readily remember, and how much did you have to look back and say, oh, I wonder what happened there?
And this probably doesn't say a lot about me and how diverse I am. Probably about 90% I remembered accurately. Definitely went back over the tape of the game to make sure I was completely accurate. You know that whole saying, the older we get, the better we were. And watching this game, the older I get, the worse I am. But it was amazing how much I had retained. And I think, I guess I equate it to this. If you have children, you remember everything about them. When they crawled, when they walked, their first day of school. You know why? Because it's so dear to you. And pitching is like that. You know, it's your profession. And something that dear, you tend to retain.
So before we get to Game 7, give us a sense of Game 6 and how you were feeling, because that is one of the great games of all time.
Well, Game 6 was, the second most historic Game 6 of that playoffs for the Mets, because the Game 6 against Houston was an amazing Game 2. Game 6 was strange because in the top of the ninth inning, Mel Stottlemyre came up to me, our pitching coach, and said, I want you to go home. I want you to get some rest for tomorrow for Game 7. We're going to win this game. The way he said it, the tone, you completely believed him. And I did. I got dressed and jumped in my car. And as I was driving down the Grand Central Parkway towards Manhattan, ball players know the silence in their home stadium. Silence is not good. And when you don't hear anything, you know that the other team has really scored a couple of runs. So I kind of wheeled it around because, you know, when you win, you want to be with your teammates. When you lose, you want to be there also. And the reason he was sending me home early is because there were 55,000 screaming New Yorkers there every single night. And we literally in the clubhouse, if the game ended at, let's say, 11, no one even got in the shower till 12:30 because you just couldn't leave. You know, the parking lot was full. That's why he wanted me to go that night. And by the time I came back, I got in the clubhouse the same time that Keith had just made the second out. And I can't repeat what Keith was saying as he came in the clubhouse. But he and I both watched the game from different places in the locker room. And baseball players are superstitious. And things started to go our way, and we stayed in the same place.
You tell the story that, and I can't imagine what this is like, but you're going down the road, your car doesn't have a radio. So it is, you're basing this all on the sound of the stadium.
I had a 1966 old English drive, four on the floor Mercedes. Ask me why I had that. I have no idea. Hubris, I'm sure. No, Murph was not on the radio, could not hear it. But ball players know the great sounds and the bad sounds. And I knew that when I heard the gasp and no sound that Boston had did something special.
So you win game six, and as you say, I mean, if it were up to you, the game would have been, you would have played two hours later.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, you're so pumped up. Your teammates are so excited. We just landed a haymaker, much to their doing. You know, I mean, you know, literally, if there's so many lucky bounces in that series, and if not for those lucky bounces, the Red Sox are celebrating 30 years of an anniversary. So we knew that, and we were fortunate for the bounces to go our way. But you also knew you had them against the ropes, you know, after a game like that. And unfortunately, there was a rainout for Game 7, so they had an extra 24 hours to kind of regroup.
Let's talk about that rainout. You write about it in the book, and it's tough for you because you've got everybody there. You got your family. Everybody's at the game waiting. You're all in the apartment, and you are doing just mental gymnastics at this point.
Well, I'm hoping it doesn't come off as excuses in the book. I wanted to let people at home know that there's so many things that happen in postseason games, and that is making sure you have the right accommodations for everyone. This is before cell phones and emails, so you had to physically call people to make sure that they had their tickets, have a place for them to all dine before and after the game. It was a royal pain in the you-know-what. but I just wanted to walk people through kind of how it was. But we also got some funny stories out of it. Before the first game in those days, futons were the big things. And I found out much later, during the 2000 World Series against the Yankees and the Mets, they had all of these celebrities write about their best experiences as a Mets fan or a Yankee fan. And Ray Romano, the great comedian, said that his greatest experience was on the night before Game 1 at Shea Stadium. He delivered a futon to Ron Darling's house. I'm so happy I gave him a $50 tip. He said it was the biggest tip he ever got, because if I had been a miser, I would have gone down in history as a buffoon in his camp. So there were a lot of like interesting little anecdotes that come from having seven people in a one-bedroom.
So the prep with that 24 hours with the rain delay, how do you then prepare, knowing, okay, it's not going to be this night, it's going to be this night?
Well, I think for me, you know, the cathartic experience about writing this book is that I was searching for the answer to that. You know, I was searching the answer that all professional athletes seek, and that is, since the time you were 6 or 7 years old, you've always been the best. When I was 7 years old, my dad couldn't catch me anymore. We couldn't play catch because I threw too hard. That doesn't make me great. It just tells you how strange it is to be an athlete on that kind of quest. And I think that, you know, what happens sometimes is just that, you know, when you have this extra time to think about it, and I had pitched now, this would be my third time in a matter of 9 days. Now it's going to be 10 days. I think cathartically, I found out that, you know, I did a lot of paralysis by analysis. I had bested the Red Sox 2 times already. I lost game one, 1-0, but I pitched a good ball game, shut him out in the second game. And instead of letting the natural arc of your athleticism play, I really thought I needed to do much more, change up my plan a bit to be successful in that third game. And, you know, I think I thought a little long and definitely wrong.
As you're on the mound, do you have a sense, and again, this is what your mind can do to you, but did you have a sense immediately that things were off, or is that just come pitch by pitch that you can redeem yourself the next time?
part of the book tries to describe that there's an irritation, an irritability that comes when there's a lot of pressure on. And a call in the second inning on June 1st would have no bearing on what you're thinking about for your next pitch. But in the second inning of Game 7 on a late October night, I just found myself so irritable about every little call that certainly I didn't think went my way. And I'm talking about pitches that I thought were strikes were not called strikes. That happens. That happens in every start that I ever pitch in the major leagues. But I think with pressure comes anxiety, comes irritability, turns into panic, and turns into sometimes bad performance. So, you know, that's why this book was so much fun to do and so awful to do all at the same time, because it was a look in the mirror kind of moment, and we probably don't do that as often as we should.
The subtitle of the book, Failure and Triumph in the Biggest Game of My Life. Once you win, is the failure erased in some way? And I mean for you and for your teammates.
Well, I do have to say that when we won, no one was more excited to run on the field. When there were 3 million people at the parade the next day, no one was more excited sitting in the convertible with my parents who had come down from Boston to be in the parade. It wasn't until 2 or 3 days later that I was sitting in my apartment alone that I kind of had to walk a shame through this game and trying to figure out what happened. For all kids, as I was describing earlier, you're on this quest where you're going to be a great athlete. And when you are, you have very little failure from the time you're 6 to 26. I mean, the failure does not come to your door because you're just usually better than other people. But when you get to the major league level, it's the most incredible scrum of all time, because every player there was the best player in their city, town, hamlet, farm, whatever it is. And they're all thrown together, and that's when the battle begins. And so that's, you know, the 2 or 3 days later, when that hit me, I thought, you know, boy, you know, sour grapes, you guys won. Don't, what are you beating yourself up about? But organically, when it was still there 3 years ago, 30 years later, I just thought, let me put some a pen to the paper and see where I get. And then a couple hundred pages later, I was still writing.
Were you talking, even at the time, were you talking to coaches? Were you talking to other players? Were you trying to examine it more than that?
No, this is kind of, it was my own private Idaho. It really was. It was something that I did not talk about, because you couldn't talk. Who were going to tell? Teammates are going to go, get over it, Ronnie. We won the game. Fans, there's many fans of the Mets, and they know everything about the Mets. Barely remember I started the game, because, you know, they know we won the game. So there was really no one to go to, so it was kind of just in my own brain that I had to kind of battle through. Everyone has their thing, right, whatever it is. But as an athlete, you have your things on the field that you can either wash away or you can't. And I couldn't wash this one away, and the book did it for me. The day I finished the book, and this is, boy, it's well over a year now, have not, other than when you and I are speaking now and with other people, I've not thought once about it. And I thought about it once a week for 30 years. It's a cool feeling.
That's a very cool feeling. When you went into the announcing booth, how much had you thought about your post-game career?
Yeah, well, I thought a lot about it. I think that, you know, when I do what I do, broadcasting, the human part of it is that I've had a tremendous amount of success, and I definitely have had failure. So I try to make sure I remember that when I'm talking about the athletes today. I think what happens for a lot of people who do my job, and I said it before, you know, the older we get, the better we were, tend to forget that, you know, they had an 0-for-4 day. They got knocked out in the second inning. And so instead of saying so-and-so was horrible today, I can say, this is why he had a bad day today. And I can list the things that happened, because I've done them myself. And I think that's really important. I find it very important in my job, because, you know, every athlete of every generation is going to have their ups and downs. And it's not for me to criticize. I have no fun in that. My job is to tell the person at home listening who are feel incredulous that someone could fail on such a large level that this is why it happens.
You have one of the best teams in broadcasting for baseball. And so I assume you realize how lucky you are.
Yeah, I was going to say that you got to be hard to assume with this with the booth we have. It's we do. We really capture when the Mets fan wants to throw something through the TV. I think we're able to answer what's going on. But I think even more importantly, I don't think you could get three more different people. And in fact, in a strange sense, Gary Cohn and I probably have more in common than Keith and I, except Keith and I have 86 and 84 and 85. And, you know, so we have a connection, an eyeball connection that Gary and I could never have because it's that ability to throw down when the pressure's high. And, you know, I've watched him come through millions of times. He's watched me come through. It's a kind of a trust factor. I would never want to compare it because I wouldn't know. But, you know, military people speak of the same kind of things, that they have such a close connection because they had to count on each other. In their instance, it's life and death. Keith and I's instance, it was a win or a loss. But, you know, Gary and I both went to Ivy League schools. We both grew up kids in a blue-collar neighborhood. You know, I wanted to be a baseball player. He wanted to, too. And then once that didn't work out, he became a baseball announcer. So I always say that our on-air show is as good as anyone does in baseball. But if ever they put a mic on us in between innings, now that would be a show.
Much is made about what you talk about during a game, which actually has nothing to do with baseball.
Yeah, we have such diverse interests. You know, Keith is we're all voracious readers. If you see us on a plane after a game traveling to the West Coast with the ball club, we're the only three guys reading on the plane. You know, all the players are watching movies or Instagramming or Snapchatting or whatever they're doing. But I can't get enough to read. Keith and Gary are the same. So we bring a lot of interest to the game. And Gary is a Mets fan. I did not grow up a Mets fan. Keith is not a Mets fan. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Keith is just, you know, Keith will talk about the Cardinals in our broadcast more than he'll talk about the Mets. So in that way, we have a lot of the diverse interests. And I think that plays with a very educated Mets fan base. I think they, you know, they don't mind the anecdotal asides during the game. Now, there's some, you know, I'm sure in St. Louis, our act would not play because I'm sure that every pitch, that's all they care about. Because you know they're so baseball rich, especially in tradition. But the Mets fan, we have a lot of fun. We talk about things that I don't think any other broadcast talks about. One broadcast, I don't know, we opened. I don't know why it came to me, but you know, I did something from Shakespeare. I don't know why I did it. The one thing about live TV is you never know what you're going to say. So we always kid, before we go on air, our big thing is we say to each other, let's not get fired tonight. Because, you know, that's kind of how we feel. We never know what you're going to say on live TV. And I don't know, one time I said, once more into the breach or something. And Keith said something like, what is that? I said, I think it's Shakespeare. And Gary, you know, Gary said, went back and forth. Keith said, Shakespeare doesn't belong, you know. So, you know, it's just you never know what we're going to talk about. And Keith is the most honest of the booth. And I think Gary and I are probably more serious. But Keith's levity is I think, the key to that because without – I mean, he's just unique. You know, And I know the Yankee broadcast when I was a kid had Phil Rizzuto, and he was the most unique personality I had heard on a lot of levels. I mean, I heard Harry Carey, but I didn't listen to him enough. But Scooter was just so brilliant in the way he approached things. Well, Keith has a lot of that in him.
I grew up with Harry Callis in Philadelphia and interviewed him shortly before he passed, and remember him saying that when he was in the booth and he was doing his job and he was calling the game, that he was the biggest Phillies fan there, and he was doing it for the fan, and he was a fan. Certainly, you're part of the Mets team, but it's not as much, is it?
You know, that's a great way to put it. Harry was one of my idols. If you ever you met him, if you haven't met him, we've really lost out. He was just a unique, amazing individual with one of the greatest voices in the history of the game. And he was. He and Whitey formed quite a team, and they were Phillies all the way. And I think that's what endeared them to the Philadelphia fans. I think our approach is a little different. Like, we absolutely are all for the Mets playing a perfect game, but we're not afraid to point out if it's not. And, you know, I know that's different, and I know the players probably really don't appreciate it. but you know, I'm not saying we don't care. Everyone wants to be liked. Everyone wants to be received well. But, you know, as opposed to before, I had 25 teammates and I'm playing for them. I got 3 million Mets fans in the tri-state area that were performing for every night. So I'm really conscious of when I'm speaking that I am speaking to them and saying, okay, I know what you just saw. This is why you saw it. This is why it happened. And I think it's important. When we were at Shea Stadium, and I really miss this, there was a little area where people used to smoke. And just to the right of it was a private area that no one could see you. And it was outside. I would walk out there at 6:45. Game starts at 7:05. And I would look out over the balcony. You'd see mothers and daughters and fathers and sons and families and cousins and coming into the ballpark. And you knew they weren't going to listen to you tonight, but probably tomorrow night. And it gave you such inspiration because these are the folks that care about what you say, and hopefully you'll get it right tonight.
The name of the new book, Game 7, 1986, Failure and Triumph in the Biggest Game of My Life. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Ron Darling, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for being in town. Thanks for spending time with us.
Joe, anytime. Thank you very much.
Again, the name of the book, Game 7, 1986. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.